Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Acquisitions Anonymous. My name is Bill D'Alessandro, and this week I'm with Michael Girdley, and we go pretty much totally off the rails in great ways. We talk about a business that liquidates old voiceover IP telephones, but we spend about 15% of the episode talking specifically about the business. And Michael and I also dig in, though, into topics like how to convince a broker that you're not a tire kicker, how to make deals with celebrities when their names are on the business, how to price a business when there's a lot of difficult to foresee risk in the future, some different deal structures about how to share risk with the seller. And we also just talk generally about the liquidations industry and some people that we've just seen make oodles and oodles of money in the liquidations industry. So it's a really good one that has much more inside than what it says on the tin. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Acquisitions Anonymous.
Hey, Michael here. Want to talk to you about today's sponsor for the episode, which is cloudbookkeeping.com. So Cloud Bookkeeping is actually run by my neighbor, Charlie. So I've met him in person and can attest that he's a real human being and a good person. And what Cloud Bookkeeping does is offer a full suite of bookkeeping services all in the cloud for you around QuickBooks and other technologies that you're using as a small business owner. So if you're interested in getting the bookkeeping part of running a business off of your plate and focusing on running your business, Charlie and his team are one to call. They can put together a bunch of other stuff in terms of helping you manage and grow your business besides just bookkeeping, sophisticated reporting, definitely helping you get your QuickBooks online set up in the right way, and a number of things around payroll as well. So definitely know them and recommend them. If you want to find out more about Cloud Bookkeeping, you can go to their website at cloudbookkeeping.com. Reach out to Charlie. I know many of you have, and see if he can help you make your running your business easier and more fun by letting them help with a lot of the bookkeeping solutions. So, and when you call, mention this podcast. It would help us and help Charlie know that we're supporting him as well. So, thanks a bunch, and cloudbookkeeping.com as the sponsor for today's episode.
All right, here we go. Another episode of Acquisitions Anonymous. You've got me and Michael this week. Michael, how are you, man? Your Spanish is struggling today, it sounds like.
It takes me 3 or 4 minutes to get warmed up. Yeah. So
and then if you don't know, when I am late to the recording, Mirko, our producer, grills Michael in Spanish. Michael's learning Spanish, as you know, from our language learning episode a couple weeks ago. So every time I'm late, Michael gets like 5 minutes of practice, and I come in to usually Michael saying, how do you say blank in Spanish? Mirko's grilling him.
Well, we did cover that it turns out that, you know, Spanish is not Spanish everywhere, and that comes up as a recurring theme, which we were discussing today, that there are like 14 different words for sandwich. Do you know how many different words there are in Spanish for turkey, by the way?
Is this like the number of words in Inuit for ice? There's a 25?
There's a lot. Yeah. And some narrow ones in slang for the word turkey. But pavo is the most common one. By the way, we're getting definite hate mail about my English or about my Spanish. But there's one rarely used one for turkey, and it is the most funniest literal translation ever. And literally some cultures refer to a turkey in Spanish as a dizzy duck. Like a dizzy duck. I don't know the exact translation, but I looked at it. I was like, what the hell is a dizzy duck? Like, this is a great language.
That's awesome. Love it. I love like all the different, you know, foreign languages that have especially colorful compound words for things. Obviously, German is famous for that. But so many languages do it. It's really fun.
Totally. And it, you know, it creates like this really fun, like, opportunity as a tourist to just go in there and say ridiculously stupid things, and there's little translations for stuff that you're just like, where did they come up with this? And then you realize, you know, I think that's fun because it also makes you think about English and American culture and how we have all these weird words as well, and we don't even think about it. Like, you know, even the very obvious ones where it's like, okay, we got to get the ball across the finish, you know, get the crawl across the ball across the goal line. Well, like, that doesn't mean anything if you play soccer, national sport. And by the way, it's not called soccer anywhere else. So it's a really great opportunity not only to learn about these other cultures, but language learning teaches you a lot about your own culture as well.
Yep. Well, the cool thing about this week is we have a deal that it relates to lots of cultures because it is about salvage and recycling. Will you read it for us, Michael?
yes, this is a very exciting one. And also in our theme of trying to do bigger deals, this one does $1.3 million a year in estimated EBITDA. So that's probably pretty close to profits, given this looks like a low CapEx business. But this one comes from Generational Equity. And, you know, Mills is not here today. So at least two of us are okay with the feel good about this brokerage choice. But anyway, the title of it is A Highly Profitable Supplier of Used and Refurbished Telecom Equipment Based in the Midwest and the Great Lakes region of the United States. So I guess somewhere between Cleveland and Milwaukee, you know, kind of what you're thinking about here. 2022 revenue for this business was $4 million estimated. So I guess as of this writing, they haven't closed out their 2022. And estimated profits is $1.3 million. So they run about, I guess, 30% EBITDA margin on a $4 million business. So pretty interesting. And you and I were talking in the pre-show, like, this type of recycling and refurbishment of stuff, like there's some really, really rich people that do this kind of stuff. It'd be interesting to see if this is one of those.
So they're liquidating phones, right? Like office phones.
Yeah. So yeah, they are a privately owned secondary market supplier of used and refurbished office phones. They specialize in new overstock inventory and work closely with corporate clients on creative solutions to liquidate overstock office phones, network switches, and private branch exchange, so-called PVS. So if you're going to have, you know, landlines in your office, they do that. And they buy from disposition folks. I guess this is a new type of, I've never seen this kind of acronym before. It's ITAD, IT Asset Disposition and Enterprise Customers located around the country. So I guess basically, Bill, this is when a big corporation has phones that are 4 years old and they're going to upgrade them. They find these groups that go and basically resell them. IT Asset Disposition, is that the way to think about this?
That's part of it. The other reason you would engage these guys is if you closed an office or you're moving out of a building or, you know, whatever. Or say if, you know, you sent most of your workforce home to work from home, you might need to liquidate a whole bunch of the phones that are still perfectly good but are on their desks. So I wouldn't be surprised if this business was a huge COVID beneficiary as all these businesses move to work from home and they've got, you know, rows and rows and rows of cubicles, each one with a phone. And no one has any use for that phone, and people are trying to recover value from those assets.
Every time I think about these like landlines, like it takes me back to the late 90s when I was like working in corporate America in an office, and you'd be like walking down the hall, and there's just like a phone is like ringing in an empty office on somebody's desk, you know? And then, and I don't know, were you around in business when people used to do mass voicemails?
Absolutely. The light would start blinking on your phone. Yeah.
So it's just for those of you that never experienced this, it was just like the craziest thing. So you know how you have that one relative who like just won't send you texts. They like record a text and send it to you. It's super annoying. By the way, I do this to my team. I send them looms. And so I'm very cognizant of sending people looms because I remember this experience. But like bosses at big companies used to send like voice memos to like 100 people at once. Like, hey guys, happy Friday. Like, we will be having bagels in the conference room, and then we're going to have a team meeting at 1 o'clock. I hope everybody can be there. And this was kind of, you know, in the transition to become email centric in business, people would do this on these phones and you'd be just sitting there. And then like, just like Bill was saying, like you'd have this huge anxiety because this, you would never hear the phone ring. Just the light, the message light would start blinking. Like it's a bad hotel room. Right? It's just like, oh no, somebody's telling me something. One to many voicemails.
And it's important to note that these phones, at least from the photo in the listing, they look like they're voice over IP phones. So like when we say landlines, I think mean it technically in the POTS, the Plano telephone system. It's almost all Ethernet connected office phone systems, right? Yeah, so modern enough, these aren't total garbage.
Cisco, Avaya type stuff where it talks over internet protocol to whatever kind of hardware is in the background and that gets on the telephone network. So more about this company. They have a client base comprised of 100 active accounts, 100 plus active accounts, 90% rate of repeat business, and they operate from a 25,000 square foot warehouse facility, and it's currently staffed by 11 full-time employees. I'll just pause there. Like 11 full-time employees to do $4 million in revenue? That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, this ain't no Chick-fil-A. Like, this is pretty cool in terms of the revenue per head here.
Yeah, I like it.
So more things to make you get excited about this and want to sign the NDA. It's a highly profitable niche business, according to the broker. Between 2019 and 2021, they averaged 34.6 EBITDA margin. And given the company's established history and consistent performance, they're well positioned to demonstrate significant profitability in the future. They have a national reach. So not only did they say that they target kind of this Great Lakes area, but they service clients wherever they may be located, and it could be expandable into these new geographies. And they have management that will remain throughout the transition. The current officers are willing to remain through the transitionary period and would entertain remaining with new management for a longer period of time on a consultancy basis. Additionally, all key employees will be available to remain with new employee ownership beyond the sale of the company. So do you read this that the owner, this is not an owner operator business, or that how do you read? I mean, is the owner running this business or not? I guess it's tough to tell from this paragraph.
It's tough. It says the current officers, which makes me believe that they would have just said owners there if that's what they meant. So this does give me hints of absentee owner business.
100%.
The thing about this though, right, is maybe the owner isn't there repackaging telephones. But this is very much a relationship business, right? Like you've got that's 90% repeat clients, it says here in the listing. So you've got to have like a couple corporate clients that are always opening or closing offices or, you know, needing to liquidate these IT assets. And you're just the guy they call. And if you lose those, you know, I think it's probably hard to break in because everybody's got a guy they call typically. Now, there's probably two types of clients here, right? There's like the good ones who are always opening and closing offices, and these are usually bigger companies. And then there's the less good ones, which is my company just went out of business. We just went virtual. It's like a one-time shot.
Yep.
You know, like you might make some money, but like that's it. And then you're hunting again. But it sounds like they've got some 90% repeat, which is pretty good.
Solid. So we'll now do a business buyer trick here to kind of think about a factor of whether it's worth calling and getting the SIM. And in the recent days, I don't know if you've seen this happening more and more, Bill, but like more and more brokers, especially small business brokers, like they're making you go through hurdles before you get the SIM. Like this is a new thing for me. It's happened in the past year or so, but because I think so many brokers are tired of having so many buyers and dealing with 30, 40, 50 people in data rooms, like a lot of times you have to have a call with the broker and like convince them that you're SIM worthy. So it's kind of like, I don't know if you remember the old Seinfeld episodes where Elaine did a sponge worthy thing. Are you old enough for this, for sponge worthy?
I think so. Yes. But for all of our listeners who have not seen this.
So, I mean, it's an interesting point, right? Like one of my new hobbies is actually to go back and watch clips of TV shows that it's just impossible for it to get made today. Like you go look at like some of what Happy Days was doing, or All in the Family is kind of the classic example where you're just like, there's no way. Or, you know, some of the Mel Brooks stuff, like there's no way that gets done today. Like just there's no way that gets through the
whole Hollywood comedy is not possible anymore.
Definitely not. So anyway, I kind of feel off describing this episode of Spongeworthiness, but basically Elaine, her brand of birth control was not going to be available anymore. So she was limiting her who she was dating based on her limited supply of these things. Then that's what the sponge worthy thing was. And this was on national TV, like Thursday night at like 7 o'clock. Like I feel uncomfortable talking about it now because the world has shifted that much in the past 25 years that you're like, I don't know if I could say that. Right. But anyway, So brokers have become like very much like hardcore, like, a lot of times you have to prove you can be like a valid buyer. They don't want tire kickers. They want to waste their time with you. So a lot of times they'll be like, yeah, call me back when you do a deal. Like I'm hearing that more and more from people. And it's really interesting. And my second point on all this is after the last 5 minutes of ranting, I don't know what my original point was, but it was really good. There was something about this deal that was. Yeah.
Well, the original point was that you got that, you know, this guy, he's got 90% repeat business and he's got the broker's generational equity. Who probably, you know, these brokers blast it to everybody and their mother, and they get a million tire kickers. 100%. So how do you prove to a broker, Michael, that you're not a tire kicker?
Okay, I remember what my point was now. I just looked at it. Okay, so one of the tricks you can do with these brokers is you 99% of the time in small business like this, the broker is co-located in the same city, with the company being sold. So you can kind of do a little trick, which is this guy, Steve Deinhardt, who's the broker, is located in the 608 area code, which I look up is Madison, Wisconsin, Southwest Wisconsin. So that's actually pretty good. Madison's like a pretty cool place to live. It's a college town. You know, UW is there, University of Wisconsin. So anyway, that was the trick. That was the whole trick.
Great anyway, trick.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I knew I could do it. I'm the Sherlock Holmes of small business buying. how do you convince somebody that you're not a tire kicker? Man, like, it's hard. Like, we've tried everything. I'm interested in your opinion on it, but like, you know, there's definitely like associating with somebody that's done deals before. So that's some of what I've tried when I've kind of partnered with other people who are doing searches and stuff, is they'll say like, well, my partner has done this, this, and this, and that's helped. But even still, in some markets where they're like, look, if you haven't done a deal in this space, like, you're wasting my time. It's very difficult. Like, we've just been told no, like, we're not going to talk to you, for example. Like, a lot of the financial services or manufacturing stuff, they're like, yeah, I'm not talking to you until you've done one deal. So that chicken and egg problem is very difficult. So I don't know if you've figured out how to solve it.
So I have a couple tips for folks, because I've dealt with a lot of business brokers, from easiest to hardest. Let me see if I can get this the right order. So from easiest, do not email business brokers from your Gmail account. Buy a domain. I mean, I know you're laughing, but like, this is basic stuff, right? You know, buy a domain. It's $9. Throw up a website on that domain. It doesn't have to be fancy. Just with a little bit of information about, and it's not about you. Like, if it's the website, just like your LinkedIn page effectively translated, that doesn't work. Try to look like a firm. Try to look like somebody who has an investment thesis. And hopefully the business you inquire about fits the thesis that's on your website. So don't email from your Gmail. Buy a domain. Email from that domain. And then the first thing the broker is going to do is click on your email signature and look at your website. Make sure the website, it can be short and sweet, doesn't need to be super complicated. It just at least mentions your investment thesis, and that should overlap with the businesses that you are inquiring about. The other thing the broker is going to care a ton about is whether you have committed capital, because they do not want to waste their time on, you know, Johnny Search Fund, who, you know, wants to buy this business and is bidding with money he doesn't have, and then has to go back to his LPs, and then the LPs veto the deal or tell Johnny he can't pay that price or whatever, right? There's just a recipe for a broken process. So brokers and sellers want to know that you have the checkbook. Even if it's not money in the bank, that's the best. Next best is, we have committed funds. We feel as though we can close in X days. You know, last best is, we're a fundless sponsor. You know, we have need LP and approval to do this deal, et cetera. So the more certain you can provide the broker that you have the cash and no one else can tell you no, and you're the decision maker, I think you get calls back.
Yeah. And we've played that game some in the past also, where you, if you're a fundless sponsor, for example, you bring in a big name partner who you have a co-investment deal with, right? And they say, okay, look, we're going to look at deals with you along the way, and here's how you're going to get cut in, and here's what you're going to do, and here's what we're going to do. And we have a committed capital fund, and that can go a long way. And it's super even more powerful if that fund has a big name that the brokers are like, oh, okay, I get it. Because like, that's the one thing like I've realized is a huge like mental fallacy that people get wrong, is they'll like, if you show up and let's say, okay, everybody knows Blackstone, right? Like, okay, Blackstone's huge. And it's like, okay, you show up and say like, well, I'm from Blackstone or I'm from GE, right? Oh, that's a big name. Okay, well, they must have money and it must be a certainty they're going to close the deal. And actually what you don't realize is, because those names are so big, like, it doesn't tell you that much. Like, there's so much kind of corporate bureaucracy that you're going to have to go through just to get a deal done with those folks, that a lot of times you have a higher likelihood of closing with a fundless sponsor who is just a search funder, right? Who's going to have to go put together financing for the whole thing. So it's this kind of mental fallacy. And it's, I think you also see it also when you co-invest with people who are like big celebrities. Have you ever done that? Like, worked on a deal?
Oh, gee. No, that sounds terrible.
I have been in deals and I fell through this mental fallacy where you're like, we're investing in this deal. And let's say it's a startup deal or whatever. And you invest in a startup deal and so-and-so big name, maybe they're on TV, right? Or they're an ex-president or like somebody who was on the Theranos board. Right? Like
Tom Brady, right? Tom Brady's co-investing.
Tom Brady's on this deal, you know, and we got Giselle on the cap table. Well, guess what? They know a lot about not tech startup investing. Like, they know how to throw footballs and be models, right? Like, it's a totally different thing. So like, you know, just because somebody's a fancy celebrity or they sometimes say smart things on TV, like you cannot assume that they're going to be additive. And actually, it's typically because they are so busy with their other stuff. Like, how helpful do you think if Jay-Z is going to be if he's on your cap table and he gives you $2 million? Like, it's just not going to happen. Like, the dudes are
zero.
Busy.
He does not care. Yep. He is not, zero.
Yeah. And actually, when things get hard, the richer somebody is, the more likely they are to just be like, well, you know, just part of my prop form here. Like, I invest $50 million a year in startups, and this is one of the million that I lose money on. And it's like, well, no, we need some help. We got to save the money. Like, get in here, do some work. No, I'm busy. I got to work on my next black album or next white album, whenever Jay-Z's next album cover theme. Anyway.
Yep. Yeah. Celebrities are very, I have looked at doing some deals with celebrities, and the level of errata coming from that side of the email account is not, seems not worth it to me.
Not good. Look, I think let's go back to this deal. So these guys recycle phones. They take used phones that happen. Let's say a company's upgrading or they're closing down the office. You know, I think we got to talk about the huge elephant in the room. I don't know how things are doing in Charlotte, but downtown San Antonio, the numbers are between 30 and 50% vacancy rate for our office buildings. Like guess where I'm at right now? I'm at my house. Like this is definitely not a tailwind business and has me scared. And they may be very busy right now because people are transitioning out of office to fully remote, but like, you got to bet. Is this business is betting that's going to come back, right? Like that's.
I don't think so. I could actually argue, Michael, that this business is betting that it goes totally work from home, right? If the whole world goes 100% work from home, think how many millions of voice over IP phones need to be liquidated. Yeah. Now, of course, at the same time, who's going to buy them, right? You got to match buyers and sellers a little bit here, but you know what. What I would think about more is just the obsolescence risk of handsets generally. You know, like how many, you know, cubicle farm workers are even going to have a hard phone on their desk? You know, all of the modern corporate phone systems are just app-based. Everybody has a smartphone, right? And so your work number rings through the app on your cell phone. So fewer and fewer people, I think the buyer's market for these is shrinking.
Totally.
And that would worry me a little bit.
Have you ever seen, there's this interesting meme on the internet. Have you ever seen where somebody does a picture and it's by year, the number of like things that used to be separate appliances and the PC or telephone like subsumed it, right? And
yeah,
eventually it got to where the PC like subsumed so many different things, everything from a desktop calculator to like a Rolodex, that eventually it got subsumed so many things that one year it just came along and unfortunately like the cell phone just went and did that to the PC. Cause like, I don't know if you've ever seen this. Like we had interns in our company. This happened in like 2019 and like, we got them desks set up and we got them like PCs and they were like 19-year-old like kids, right? Young people. And, they show up and like, okay, I'm like, okay, I need you to reformat this PowerPoint. And I go over there and they're not using the PCs. They're reformatting the PowerPoint on their phones. I'm like, what is going on here? What is going on here? But I think to your point, like, you know, who wants to pay $400 for like an Avaya phone system? Like, why do you need this? Like, just integrate it on the computer. Like another head. Anyway, that's just my headwind thesis on this. I'm like, oof, not great.
So you want to hear something really stupid that I actually own? So I actually own, I don't have it, so I can't show it on the video, a USB handset, like from like a payphone, like a plastic chunky handset. You know, and you can plug it into your computer and it has, you know, a speaker in the ear and a microphone in the mouth, and you can actually hold it up to your head. Because honestly, like this little rectangle of metal and glass is not super comfortable to hold up against your face for a while. You can't like do the thing, you know, where you put your ear on your shoulder and you kind of hold the phone hands free, right? So if you call me on the phone, there's a chance I am talking to you on a fake payphone that is attached to my computer. Because it's a better tactile experience. So this deal though, like, so it's making $1.3 million. Generational equity does the thing where they don't have an asking price.
Yeah.
Is there a price that you would buy this at, right? Like this guy is making over $1 million a year, essentially hustling and flipping these handsets. You know, is this a saleable business? There might not be any terminal value to it in 10 years, but you could make $13 million between now and then.
Yeah, look, I think you have a headwind here. Like, I think there's some significant headwinds. And having spent time working out businesses with tailwinds and headwinds, I can tell you which one is much more fun. Tailwinds are a ton more fun than headwinds. Headwinds cause you to do a bunch of really painful, tough decisions, and tailwinds make you not have to do those things. And so I think that's the reason I would be personally scared of this, is just because life's too short. You know, I've got enough battle scars from headwinds. But look, I think you could do really well here. Do I think this business should trade at, you know, 5 or 8 times EBITDA? Definitely not. Like, you know, I think this starts to get interesting at 2, 3, 3.5 times, especially if there's some performance earnout that's tied to the seller. You know, I think that's really, that's where I would kind of price this. And if it was priced around there, I think it would be interesting for the right buyer. Like, do you want to live in Madison? Do you want to do what this guy's doing? Because it's not like you can pick this thing up and move it to Charlotte. Like, your clients and your people and everything is, you're living in Madison for this deal, assuming that's where it is.
So to me, the major diligence item is the customers, right? Yeah. Because what makes, if this business is a bad business, it's a guy that's country club friends with a few VPs at large corporations. And so he gets the work, right? Like, that's a bad business. If this is a good business, it's professionally branded. It has an in to the IT department at Target or whatever, pick your Midwestern headquartered company, right? It's on the official vendor list for a couple Fortune 500s, right? And they're the go-to guys to liquidate the phones. And in that case, the question is, I got to get a call on the phone with the IT guy at Target and see what else I can liquidate for them. Like, the value here is tapping into whoever these customers are. I guarantee you they're liquidating a lot more than phones. If you're liquidating a phone, you're almost certainly liquidating a desk chair and a computer, like, yep, at the same time, right? And office furniture and printers and routers and network equipment and all this other stuff that is immediately tangential to these things. So if this business, you know, has procurement numbers and is in with some large Fortune 500s, that would be some potential real expansion you could have. If it's just a guy with some country club relationships, as our friend Brent from Permanent Equity would call it, a hustler with help, you know, that's wheeling and dealing and flipping phones, that's less attractive. But if this is ingrained in some corporate IT procurement, that's potentially interesting.
Yeah. So let's say you wanted to buy this business. How would you structure it? By the way, I've gotten this DM a couple times. They're like, I wish you would tell me how to structure these deals. So let's say you could buy the business for 3 times EBITDA, which, by the way, I think EBITDA versus free cash flow is a number to really look at here. It looks like they are taking possession and creating inventory of the things that they buy from these companies. And this is telephone equipment. So it is highly likely they are depreciating everything in year one. So there's some bonus depreciation going on here, but also massive depreciation means you have capital tied up. So inventory turns seem like something very important here. But let's say that's a pretty close approximation of free cash flow, and you can buy it for 3 times earnings. How do you structure something like this?
So I wouldn't pay upfront. I think you bring up a great point about the value of the inventory. The inventory is probably worth, it's weird because it's worth zero, and then also whatever you can sell it for all at once. So I think a lot of this inventory comes, they'll get it for free a lot of the times. Half the time on this liquidation stuff, the prices show up and make it disappear, right? So they go into these office buildings and they just round it all up and they pay you pennies on the dollar or even nothing, right? So I don't know how you value that inventory. So you'd have to find some way to like actually go through the, what I guarantee you is a warehouse full of a giant rat's nest of like phones and old, I mean, like the warehouse in this thing has got to be impressive, right? Scary. So you got to figure out how to value that. I would not pay for the inventory at all because let's be real, he knows what it's worth way more than you. So I would try to structure a price where he's going to share in whatever money we make over a period. Maybe he gets $1 million up front, you know, tops, and then he gets 75% of EBITDA the first year, 50% of EBITDA the next year, 25% of EBITDA the next year, and 5% of EBITDA the next 3 years after that. So, and I don't know if my math works, but then it adds up to 3x EBITDA, right, over time. That's how I would structure it.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So, I mean, a classic searcher would do this. Let me give you the classic searcher. Let's say the price is 3 times EBITDA, it's $4 million. You just described something that put a lot of the risk on the seller. But the classic search would be like, oh, okay, 3x EBITDA. You know, I'm going to go do 2 turns of EBITDA, or let's say out of the 4 million, I'm going to go two and a half turns of EBITDA. So I'm going to do 3.5 million as an SBA note, and then another 500K in equity or full standby note, you know, that the SBA lender likes, and the seller walks with that much more. So I think what's interesting here is you just described a way that it's much harder to do the deal you did, which that's a screaming deal. And that's the way you would structure, because you do screaming deals. That's why you're very successful. Other people structure stuff the other way I just described, which, like, the big difference there is you put all the risk on the seller with a little bit upfront. Yeah. And the SBA route, who takes all the risk there? The buyer does.
So I thought it was very interesting. Guaranteeing buyers who takes all the risk, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's very interesting because the more time I spend with really rich people, there's just a great way to get really rich. Only do screaming deals. That's it. Like, just don't do anything that's not a screaming deal. And like, you have a huge margin of safety there where you're just like, I'm doing screaming deals. And what you described to us as a screaming deal, like, I would invest in that deal. Like, that's a good deal. Like, let's do that deal.
Yeah.
The problem is there's a lot of stupid people out there that are sometimes bidding up assets and prevent you from doing screaming deals. So
anyway, yeah, I think the reason that I tend toward the structure that I did is there's two things here embedded in this deal that I think are very hard to handicap, to estimate the risk of. And whenever it's hard to estimate the risk, if the risk I can understand, I can price it, right? But when you can't really understand the risk, you can't price it. And so you have to share it with the seller. It is sort of my general framework. And this thing has two bits of risk that I can't really price. Thing one is what we mentioned, or what you mentioned before, is like, are people even going to be using these phones in 5 years? Like, is there any terminal value to this business at all? Is how much of this is COVID? What happens to the office real estate market going forward? Like, these are heady questions that no one knows the answer to, on which trillion-dollar industries hinge. And right. If you could predict, you would be very much wealthier than if you bought this deal. So that's one. I can't price that risk, right? So I need the seller to share that risk with me. The other thing that I have a hard time pricing is I know that this is 90% repeat business, but it's not reoccurring. It's recur, or whatever the difference is. It's not recurring. It's reoccurring. Like, each one's its own deal. You know, like, Target closes a store, they call you, you make 20 grand. You wait until Target closes the next store, and then they call you and you make 20 grand. Right. So you're not in control of your demand really on this. And it's like you're just making deals and stacking up deals, and relationships matter, and kind of that seems very hard to price for me going forward.
Yeah.
So for those reasons, I would want to share it with the seller.
And that's why you're the Mr. Wonderful of the podcast.
Oh, God.
I think that's a great case. I don't know if you've ever, it's really interesting. Let me try to say this in a politically correct way. It is very interesting to go look at when people actually dig into the claims that people who purport to be very rich are making. And it's one of those things where there's like an inverse thing where people who tell you how rich they are and espouse it are usually, it's usually not true. Like, the rich people, the really rich people that you and I know, like, they just walk around like normal schmucks because they realize how expensive it is to go tell everybody how rich they are. So like, there's this idea where it's like, okay, like, you should really be careful if somebody's telling you how rich they are. But if you kind of have to figure it out, like, that's a pretty good sign they're probably actually really rich. So anyway, about that particular Mr. Wonderful.
Speaking of really rich, I know some exceedingly wealthy guys in liquidations, which is what this is. This is liquidations. I know some bananas wealthy guys in like clothing liquidations, electronics liquidations, like basically we'll buy whatever shit you're selling at the right price, like government auctions, store closing sales. They buy out all the inventory and then they sell it on Amazon I know a guy who buys all of the closeout inventory from like almost every retail clothing store that closes, just buys it all. And he has so much that he has opened his own chain of stores, retail stores, populated only with the closeout merchandise.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and he crushes it. Like, they have these in malls and stuff. I mean, like, so much money. It's crazy. Private jet money.
So I think the coolest thing, and I've seen it before, like, if you can figure out how to get the person who's supplying you the good that you're going to go resell, if you can get them to pay you to take it, like, and then you sell it, like, I've seen that model before. And truly, like you, I can't tell you exactly who these people are because I don't want to out them because they're making so much money. Like they're very secretive because it's like they don't want anybody to come in and they're, you know, they work with a factory or they work with somebody and it's like, hey, like, do you want me to clean up all those like iron shavings that you have there? And like, why don't you pay me to do that? And they get that contract. And the next thing you know, it's like they're the world's biggest iron dealer. And it's like they're making money on both sides. Which is just so, it's just beautiful when you see it. Like I envy some of these folks. So as somebody who pays a lot of money for inventory, amen. You do you.
There's a business that I'm not under NDA for, but so I can talk about generally. It's cooking oil recycling. Do you know about these businesses?
Yeah. We did one on the podcast. It was a day you didn't make it.
Yeah. Phenomenal. Like they come to restaurants and empty out the fryers. And they charge the restaurant to dispose of this because it's like hazardous waste. You can't just like throw it in the dumpster, right? Or they even will set up these special oil dumpsters like out behind the restaurants. And so they empty their fryers into the oil dumpster and then they drive around a truck and suck it out and they charge the business. I don't know what they charge them, hundreds of dollars a month to dispose of this oil waste. They get it back to the facility and like they clean it and like turn it into biodiesel or resell it. And they're making it coming and going. They're awesome businesses.
Did you ever hear the story it's a public company now, but the lady who was a Chinese immigrant to the US and when the big flood of Chinese goods started happening, you know, she figured out that all of the container ships going back to China were going empty and basically she could pay nothing for freight going that way. And what most people don't know about China is not a lot of raw materials, not many trees. Like it's the opposite of America. Like America is like the most gifted company geographically in the world, like by far. Another random Gen X facts that you can make fun of me about. Did you know that it's something like more than half of the navigable waterways in the world are in the United States?
Like really?
Yeah, and by the way, that's the cheapest way to travel, to make goods travel. So anyway, that's a girdly fact. It was, when I heard it was extraordinarily high. Google it yourself, but it is unreal. Like what the Mississippi Delta system and all those rivers on the West Coast, like we have like the greatest gift to mankind. So you may be Googling this, but anyway. So what she discovered was like, because China needed raw cardboard to package up all these materials that they're sending to the US, she could go buy all the cardboard around in the US, ship it back to China, sell it there. And this would be billions of dollars a year. And so she's a billionaire. Just because she found these goods that nobody wanted in the U.S. is waste paper. She shipped it back. They recondition it, turn it into boxes. Do you ever wonder why cardboard boxes are brown?
I assume that's just what color they are, right? They're recycled. They grind up the pulp and that's the color.
Yeah. I've seen the cardboard recycling operations. They have these giant vats. They heat up the cardboard. They cut out all the stuff that's in it. And when you cook it down, it turns that color. And there will be guys like standing over the top of it. Yeah, it's a color of cardboard sludge. And it comes out the other side. It looks like that. But if you take all of the recycled cardboard and you put it back, that's what comes out of it. And like I saw a dude once, I was watching one of these operations in China. And like the dude's entire job was to stand over a vat of boiling water where they were cooking the recycled cardboard and fish out using a pitchfork all of the pieces of plastic and metal that would float to the top. And that was his whole job all day. And they cook it and it squirts out the other side. And there's these machines that make boxes. It's crazy.
It'd be really sad when that guy dies of cardboard cancer, inhaling all those fumes all day long, cooking cardboard.
And then at the time, do you know what they did with the wastewater after they cooked the cardboard? They put it in the river.
Turn it into animal food or something? I don't know.
They put it straight in the river. Went straight in the river. That doesn't happen as much anymore. Like the central government cracked down on a lot of that pollution. But like at the time, it was like 7-8 years ago, they were just putting, I was like, where's the water go? They're like, there's the river. The river.
That is the default mode of trash disposal for most of human history, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
You just take it to the river and you throw it in.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. That's why people are like, you know what we need to bring back to the United States? Textile manufacturing and all this stuff. I was like, there's no way. Like, it's impossible. Like, you can't.
It's impossible to compete because, when you can't, like, flush the waste down the river, right?
Unbelievable. Difficult. Anyway, man, we went on some, like, super duper tangents today.
This was a tangent-filled episode. All right. Let's wrap this one up. That was not at all about recycling telephones, but I think we talked about some very interesting things this week. So thanks for listening for another episode of Acquisitions Anonymous, the internet's number one podcast about buying and selling businesses. We will see y'all next time.